Welcome to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word. We are going to tell the story of Judah, which takes place during the years that his younger brother Joseph is a slave in Egypt and then becomes the vizier of Egypt. And so we will kind of fast-pace this Judah story, and then we'll kind of rewind and go back and follow Joseph shortly after. So chapter 38 begins with this comment. It happened at that time. Now, the time that's being referenced is the time when Joseph gets sold into Egypt by his brothers. Now, just to put a date on that, that's 1908 going into 1907 BC. Joseph was 17, which means that Judah would have been probably 21 or so, maybe 22. And Judah may have already been married, as we will find in this story, at the time that he was involved in his brother's sail into slavery. But in order to appreciate what happens when the entire family of Israel, including Judah and his family, goes down to Egypt, we have to know that this whole story has unfolded during the intervening 22 or so years. So it happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers, and he turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Now, Adullam is a city, a community, toward the western side of what will eventually become Judah territory. It's southwest of where Jerusalem is located. Not very far from the battle location between David and Goliath. So he leaves the area where his brothers are helping run his father's sheep to kind of strike out on his own, apparently, seek his own fortune. And so he's down here, makes a relationship, and falls in love, as we would say. Verse 2, there Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, which is why this woman will be referred to in some passages as Bathshua, which means daughter of Shua. He took her, and he went into her. So that's just the shortcut for got married. So again, I would suggest to you that this part of the story may have already happened, and Judah was, you know, kind of going back and forth between where he's developing his own individuality and helping work with his brothers, taking care of father's things. So she gets pregnant, she bears a son, and he calls his name Er. She conceived again. So we've got time passing here. If the norm procedure kind of happens, there's going to be a couple years or more between births. And she called this second son Onan. Yet again, she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. And then Judah was in Kizib when she bore him. So we've got three named sons of Judah, born perhaps some of them before the sale of Joseph into Egypt, and perhaps others after. So they are growing up, and while stories are happening with Joseph, These guys are old enough that they start wanting to get married. Now, in order for it to fit into the time bracket that we need, it appears to me as if these young men want to get married while they're in their late teens. And so Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name is Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of he who is, and he who is put him to death. We have no other information than that. Did he get sick? Did something miraculous happen where he is executed? Like, did he get hit by a bolt of lightning or something like that? No details. All we know from the prophet Moses, who is providing this information, is that he was a bad guy. So bad that God would not let him continue living. And he must have only been in his teens. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife, perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother." Now, this is referred to by the term leveret marriage, which just basically means brother-in-law marriage. We see it codified in the Jewish law later, but this is long before the Jewish law, so that means it must have already existed as a regular practice among the peoples of the lower Middle East. Now, what's the purpose of it? Well, you've already heard me say that this culture is completely different than the one we're kind of familiar with in modern times. Marriage was not about two people hitting it off and developing a relationship and loving one another and wanting to get married and making that choice. It was, in this period, much more family involved. And so families were involved in the process. And part of the reason the families were involved in the process is because of line of inheritance, family property rights. You want to make sure that the eldest boy gets married to the right woman who will help raise that next generation of boys who will then take control of that family property and do right by it. So if the eldest son, the heir, dies without having any sons, then the family would expect the next son in line, who's not already married, who is not already betrothed, to volunteer to marry her and to have children with her. And that first son would be counted as the heir. Continuing, though, in this case, you've got son number one dies, son number two is asked to step in, and what does he do? Verse number 9, Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. We see this, again, in the Jewish code, in the Jewish law that Moses puts out, that when the brother-in-law marries in the place of his late brother, the first son is considered the son of the dead man, and therefore the heir of all the property. Any sons beyond that will be the heir of the actual second son. But what happens if you don't have any kids other than that first son? Or maybe you have that first son who belongs to your older brother, dead as he is, and he becomes the heir, but then you don't have any boys. You only maybe have girls. Well, then you have no one to pass your portion of the property onto. And so your lineage dead ends, And so that is exactly what Onan is thinking about here, is why should I have children for my brother? So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground so as to not give offspring to his brother. Now this, again, totally different culture. We have a hard time getting this into our head. And I apologize that I have to be kind of graphic in some of this because the Bible is graphic about it. There were conjugal rights between a husband and a wife. The man had to perform sexual activity with his wife on a regular basis with the intention of having children, particularly an heir. He could not get out of that. So apparently this guy decides to practice a technique of birth control called coitus interruptus. So he has performed the technical part of conjugal rights, but he has denied the opportunity for her getting pregnant. The belief at this time amongst a lot of these folks is that the woman was like the soil and the man's seed was what really grew inside of her. And so he is trying to deny the opportunity for a child to be raised by her in the name of her dead husband, his older brother. And so this is exceptionally rude. It is exceptionally rebellious against the whole point of this levirate marriage. And so verse number 10, Moses reports, what he did was wicked in the sight of he who is, and he, meaning God, put him to death also. So we find out from this, apparently, Judah's not raising good guys. Now we know that he's got problems too. I mean, even though he wasn't on board with killing Joseph, he still was treating him poorly, apparently, with his other brothers as he was being raised up. And so his first two sons, Judah's first two sons, are apparently very self-centered and sinful, and they both end up dead. But this is what Judah thinks. Judah is thinking that maybe it's the woman. You know this weakness that can happen in parents, that my child can't be the one that's at fault. The other people must be the problem. And so that seems to be where Judah goes with this. So in verse 11, Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, twice now, because his first two boys married her, remain a widow in your father's house. So he doesn't even want her around his property. You remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up. Now Shelah is probably only a couple of years from being old enough to marry this woman. So Moses tells us specifically that he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Judah thinks that she's the problem. She is some sort of unlucky connection. She is a curse. And that he's already lost two boys to her, and he doesn't want to lose his third. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. Now, she is considered a widow, but she is also, in a way, considered to be betrothed to Shelah. So she is supposed to stay unaffiliated, unconnected to any other men, at her father's house, wearing widow's clothing. Now, verse 12. in the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. So we are probably a good 20 years into his story at this point, which means that probably down in Egypt, we're getting ready to have the end of the seven good years and the beginning of the bad years. But Judah now is grieving over the loss, not just of son number one and son number two, but now he's grieving over the loss of their mom, who was a Canaanite, by the way, which might have contributed to these boys' bad thinking. When Judah was comforted, meaning the 30 days of grief or whatever the time period was, had finished, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. So he goes to Timnah, where apparently his flock is located, here at the transition from spring to summer when sheep shearing time comes. Sheep shearing tends to be a very celebratory harvest of resources. There's contests that happen even in modern day sheep shearing where you try to see who gets the most sheared wool in a day, who can take the most wool off of one sheep in one big fleece, things of that nature. So you're working and working all day long, and then you party. You celebrate in the evening, and then you get up in the morning and you start all over again. So that's the environment. Days of hard work followed by nights of celebration. Now, verse 13. When Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she took off her widow's garments. Remember the special clothing that identifies her as a widow. And covered herself with a veil, so she puts a veil over her face, wrapping herself up, and she sat at the entrance to Enayim, which is on the road to Timnah. So she goes to this specific place on the way to Enayim. It's actually Double Spring is the name of it. So it was probably a place where there was a special water site. And the reason that she did this is because she's got something very specific in mind. It says, for she saw that Shiloh was grown up, so he was of marriageable age now, and she had not been given to him in marriage. So Judah did not follow through. It's possible, although it's not in the text, it's possible that there were rumblings going on in the family that Shelah was going to be betrothed to someone else. And that would leave her out in the cold. Verse 15. Now, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Now, this is Cana. This is a place that has all of the pagan traditions and activities that are part of that world. So sex workers, even sex workers that offer a chance to worship some deity by having sex with them, all of those are common practices in the world here. And so it's made clear there's some sort of traditional way of covering your face or dressing yourself that advertises, "I am available for a price." So she has gone here specifically to hook her father-in-law. Now, this means that she probably was aware he already made use of such prostitutes since his wife's death. He may have been making use of prostitutes since before she passed away. But she goes there to the exact spot that she knows he has to come past with the hope that he'll be attracted. Now, she may have had to turn down others because she's out here fishing for one particular guy. Verse 16 tells us that she caught him. He turned to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come in to you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. Now she said, and probably disguising her voice, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" So let's negotiate the cost. He answered, "I'll send you a young goat from the flock." Now, for some reason, he does not have silver on him. Or maybe she says, "I don't take silver. I take animal products or produce." So that's what he offers. And she said, "Well, if you give me a pledge until you send it." So, all right, I'll take the goat, but you need to leave some collateral so that I know I'll get paid. So he said, "Well, what pledge shall I give you?" And she replied, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that's in your hand." So she picks his identity information. The signet here is probably a cylinder seal, which is a little seal, a little carved seal. It's a cylinder, just like I said. It's on a cord, which is mentioned here. And it has a picture that is made when you roll it across the clay. So this is what you use as your signature, your official seal whenever you make business deals. So it is very personalized. The staff that you use in your work as a shepherd, because that's what he is, you personalize it over time. Carve your name on it, carve pictures on it, because you got time on your hand out there watching the animals. So it is very personalized and individualized to the shepherd. So she basically asks him, "I want your driver's license and your social security card." And he hands it off. Things that would easily identify as belonging to him. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Now, he was there for sexual relief. Perhaps just generically, or maybe it's got something to do with his grief over his lost wife. But she is there with something else in mind. "I am owed a baby from this family." That was what the betrothal agreement with the first son guaranteed to me. I didn't get it from him. I should have got it from the second son. Didn't get it. I should have been able to get it from the third son, but I'm not getting him either. So by golly, I will get this baby on my own. So that's what she does. She basically tricks Judah into giving her what was promised, a baby. Verse number 19, "Then she arose, she went away, taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood." So she goes back home, goes back to normal procedures as a widow. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he didn't find her. And he asked the men of the place, "Where's that cult prostitute who is at the Enaim at the roadside?" And they said, "Well, there's no cult prostitute that's been here." And so he returned to Judah and said, "I haven't found her." Also, the men of the place said, "No cult prostitute has been there." So it's like, it's a puzzlement. I couldn't pay her because nobody knew where she was. So Judah replied, "Well, just let her keep the things as her own, or we're going to be a laughingstock. You see, I sent this young goat, and you didn't find her." So he was hoping to just get her paid off, but can't. So he's like, "No, well, let's just move on. I'll make a new seal, and I'll make a new staff, and we'll just forget about it. I tried to pay her, but couldn't." Now, about 3 months later, meaning she's showing, Judah was told, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she's pregnant by immorality." So the family has to have a crisis meeting. That is, your daughter-in-law, who is supposed to be on hold, waiting for a new relationship, has not apparently waited. She is now pregnant outside, not just of marriage, but also out of betrothal. And so Judah, as the patriarch of the family, has the judicial discretion of what to do. Judah says, bring her out, let her be burned. Burning was at this time one of the punishments for sexual immorality. Now he sees it pragmatically, I think. Wow, I can get rid of unlucky Tamar and move on with my life. But she does this. As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these belong, I'm pregnant. She said, please identify those whose these are, the signet, the cord, and the staff. And Judah identified them and said, oh, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah. And he did not know her again, meaning he didn't have sexual activity with her ever again. Now, why is this story so important? Well, we're not going to be able to quite get there just yet. But we'll save back the actual text until next time. But this is the issue. You will find Tamar mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus' family. Because you see, this is the family tree of Jesse and his son David and his son Solomon, and for that matter, his son Nathan, who's Solomon's little brother. So this is actually a story inside the family tree of the royal family of Israel, and therefore of Jesus himself. Mark your place. We'll come back here next time we're into the Word.